Vacation starts with VA. Whether you're feeling beachy, mountainy, or every-y in between, you'll find all that you love all in one trip to Virginia. Start yours at virginia.org.
Knowing how to speak and understand a new language can be an invaluable tool when traveling, meeting new friends, or just even to master a new skill. But it's not always simple when you're bogged down by textbooks and structure classes. That's why so many people trust Rosetta Stone. Rosetta Stone is the most trusted language learning program, available on desktop or as an app. It truly immerses you in the language you want to learn, like Spanish, French, Italian, Chinese, and more. You won't just be studying English translations. The Rosetta Stone intuitive process helps you pick up a language naturally, first with words, then phrases, then sentences. Don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/rs10. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/rs10 today.
Welcome back to The Peripheral. On today's episode, I speak with Travis Myers. He was a New York Police Department detective way back in the day. He's a veteran, and he was in New York at the time of the September 11th attacks. This interview has been 2 years in the making. We've been going back and forth, meeting each other at conventions and whatnot. Travis is also an author, and he writes fictional books, but based not so loosely on real-life situations he had found himself in. It was funny, we never really got around to talking about his books during this interview, so I'm going to supply links in the show notes, but he has a series of books out there. You can find them on Amazon or wherever you buy your books from. Search for Sister Margaret. Travis writes it with his sister. He has 3 books in the series thus far. So with that, here is Travis.
Well, I'm very honored to have you on. We had met at CrimeCon briefly, but there's so many people at CrimeCon just coming and going that it's really hard sometimes to have a long conversation and get to know somebody. But I'm super appreciative that you reached out and said, hey, do you guys want to talk still? And I was like, yes, thank you for following up, because I'm terrible at following up.
I'm so happy. Well, first of all, yeah, it was really nice chatting with both you and Aaron at CrimeCon. Yeah. You know, I met so many people there, and you guys were actually not only very nice to talk to, but rememberable. You know, I enjoyed meeting you guys. But then, yeah, it was just a funny thing. I was getting ready. You know, we have CrimeCon coming up again, and I had a bag full of shit from, oh, am I allowed to curse on this?
Yes, sorry. Absolutely.
Okay, cool. So I had a bag full of shit from last CrimeCon, and sure enough, there was your little note, give us a call. And I'm like, man, it's been months. Let me give these guys a call. And so I reached out, and well, here we are.
Yeah. I want you to introduce yourself, and through that, we'll go into your history and what you do or what you did and why you got into law enforcement. So go ahead and introduce yourself.
Okay. Well, I'm Travis Myers, you know, retired New York City police detective. I was I'm a veteran also. I served in the 82nd Airborne Division in the Army, if you're familiar with that. And basically, you know, before that, I was a New York City street urchin, just a, you know, regular kid, you know, ran around the streets of New York City back in the 70s and 80s when I was young.
You lived in New York all your life?
Yes. I live some people might call upstate. If you live upstate, then we're really not upstate. I'm about a little more than an hour north of New York City right now.
Yeah. I had a whole like weird disagreement about what's considered upstate New York. And I said, well, most people in New York City consider anything north of New York City upstate, whereas the rest of the world, we think Rochester, Buffalo, Syracuse.
Exactly. Well, that's a funny thing there too, just because I'm going to be arrogant right now. You know, New York City is the premier city in the world, so to speak, right? It's the center of finance. It's the center of it is a fantastic city. And so, yes, we always thought the same thing. You know, I used to have a joke, anything west of Macy's is wilderness country. And literally, once you pass the Bronx to get into Westchester, that for us was upstate, which it certainly is not. I mean, New York State is giant. And really, true upstate is kind of north of Albany. So, yeah. You know, and everybody that's north of Albany thinks we're downstate. In fact, they even say that downstate. We even have a downstate prison.
When you were a kid, when you were growing up and the teacher asked you, what do you want to do when you grow up? What was your answer?
Oh, geez. You know, I can't say. I know you're probably getting towards the police officer thing.
Yeah.
I did want to become a police officer probably when I was more in my mid-teens, somewhere in there. Now, for myself, well, just going to school in general, I was a fairly truant child. You know, I dropped out of school in ninth grade, all right, at the very old age of 15, and started working, you know, construction jobs, because you could do that back then. You know, I worked for a liquor store. I worked for a couple of bars. My first job ever, actually, was working at a candy store when I was about 12 years old. Mm-hmm. And then at that same age, I started working in a pub that was downstairs from the apartment that we lived in.
Child labor laws be damned back then.
No, it truly. Yeah, no, I mean, you know, it was everybody was paid cash and a lot of that still exists. And tell you what, I always tell people I learned more working in that bar than I ever learned in school anyway. I really did. I learned more about life, learned more about people. So, yeah, as far as the cop thing, if that's the road we're going to go down, I would say I took my first police. I went in the Army when I was 17 and I'd already taken my first police exam because you could do that back then. But for me, like so many street kids, I wasn't so much a real fan of the police. So we had to deal with them ourselves in the neighborhood. But it was the detective thing that kind of turned me on. You know, the detectives would show up after the fact, you know, with their sport coats or their suits and their pinky rings. And, hey, come here, kid. I got a couple of questions for you. And they were just the coolest guys in the world to me.
Yeah.
As opposed to the police officers, even though it is very much the same job in the same department. You know, the police officers were the no-nonsense uniform guys that showed up and told you to get off the corner, confiscated your beer and threw it in the trunk, roughed you up if you were a little fresh, went through your pockets for weapons, things like this, you know, which at the time, of course, you hate. But in retrospect, especially after having the job, I completely understand what they were doing because they were doing their job. So police work wasn't necessarily a lifelong dream for me. But for us, we had... In our neighborhood, it's funny, New York City is, you know, again, one of the biggest cities in the world, right? And definitely the biggest city in the country. However, neighborhoods are quite often like small towns. And for us, you know, you had, I don't want to say a lack of opportunity because we had every opportunity that everybody had. But most of the people I grew up with went into like the 580 union, which is steelworking, okay? Or they were 32B guys, which is doormen and maintenance men. And then, of course, you know, it's always a union job that you wanted, right? And some of the best union jobs, of course, are civil service, police department, fire department, sanitation. You know, people say sanitation. Sanitation is a great job in New York City. Being a garbage man in New York City is a great, great job. Great benefits, great everything. And of course, then, you know, the unsung heroes, the EMTs. I don't think paramedics and EMTs get nearly the credit that they should because that's a really, really ridiculous job to have. And they literally are saving lives every day.
People that live in small towns think they don't have a lot of opportunity because grandpa worked at the factory, dad worked at the factory, now I'm going to work at the factory. But it actually does apply to big cities too, because a lot of people, especially when I lived in Los Angeles or I've been to New York, they don't leave their neighborhood.
Right.
You know, and it's weird to me because I've lived all over the country. I've lived all over Kansas City, but there's a lot of people that just stick to, I don't want to call it a bubble, but it's this small area.
Especially for working class people. And it is, you know, a line of poverty, I guess, is where is there, where you really can't, you know, you can't afford to go to a prep school as a child. You go to public school. If you go to college, you're not going to go to the best colleges, to the good colleges. I can name two of my friends, of all the guys that I hung out with and girls that I hung out with, two that for a fact that I know that finished college. We just didn't do it. And it was not so much my day or my time. A lot of it was our demographic. It didn't happen. And for us, I think part of the neighborhood thing was we didn't really aspire that much for that. For us, it was get yourself a good union job, get yourself a good woman, and get on with your life. You know, and I'm not a dinosaur. You know, I'm pushing 60 now, but it sounds like I'm talking like a guy from the 1940s. But it was true. For a working guy, you know, you wanted a really good job that had some benefits, that had some security. And if you're lucky, like I say, you know, first time get married will be the last time. And that's really what has happened for me. It's been a good run for me overall.
Did the military help you with your law enforcement career?
Yes, the military helped me in a lot of ways. it was the old, I'll say the best thing I ever did in my life was going into the service. Okay. And granted, I was only 17 at the time. Add to that, I think the second best thing I ever did was getting out. And what do I mean by that? I think for a young man who's got nothing going on in his life, all right, the military is a great first step. Okay. Because it can help make a man out of you, if you will, because for a lot of people, they have no guidance, they have no discipline, they have, you know, like myself, you know, my father took a powder on us when I was like 11 years old. Now, I was lucky enough to have a father and to know who he was, because a lot of people don't have that at all. But my brother and I, my brother, who's not really adopted, he came to live with us when he was about 12, 13 years old. My home life was maybe a little more attractive than his was, and my mother took him in. He'd come over for the weekend and stayed his entire life, you know, and we were in the army together. He also went on to be a police officer as well. But that's a whole other side story. So yeah, leaving the military was great because I just thought there were so many more things to do with my life. And I made the right decision. You know, I'm happy that I wasn't, even though, again, I said the military was the best thing I ever did with my life. It was not where I wanted to spend my entire life.
I joined in 94 when I was 17. And they deactivated me because my job was obsolete in like 97, 98. I don't remember. And then they sent me orders to go to Afghanistan after September 11th. And I'm like, I have not been in the military for over 5 years now. Like, I'm not going to Afghanistan.
Because you had the eight-year commitment, right?
Yeah. And so they ended up sending me my honorable discharge papers. But, you know, if I had been in the military the entire time, I would have gone. But the fact that they deactivated me, I was like, I am not prepared for this. You can't send me across seas to do this thing because it won't work out very well for me.
Now, what branch of the service were you with?
I was with the Army.
You were in the Army also? Okay,
yeah,
cool.
Yeah.
Cool.
So,
well, it's funny that you say that. My military experience was something, obviously, I went at 17, same as you, as my brother did. But I was an 82 Charlie, which also doesn't exist anymore. Field artillery, land surveyor. Basically, what we were glorified forward observers. Call in airstrikes, call in artillery. You know, we could do it with anybody that had the big guns. But then they came out with this thing called PADS. And we were being in the 82nd. We were the first guys to get this thing. And PADS was a position azimuth determining system. And so it would take me and you to pick it up and put it up on the back of a Jeep and screw it in and then type in our stuff. And it would bring that target down to like the size of the dime anywhere on Earth. It was a fantastic thing. And all it was the original GPS that you have in your wristwatch today. You know,
that's so weird.
What has happened with technology is so fantastic because, again, like I say, I'm getting close to 60, but I mean, how long ago was that? It really was only, well, I guess maybe 40 years ago.
For a guy that's been in the military, has been a detective, who's gone through some stuff, you look really good for almost being 60.
Well, thank you very much. Well, thank you, sir. I appreciate it.
So when did you decide and become a detective? And what is that process to become a detective? Do you have to become a beat cop first and then get promoted?
Yes.
Okay.
So it works the same for everybody. You know, you take a written test, you're hired off that test, and you go through the other, you know, the psychological exam, the physical exam, et cetera, et cetera. Once you pass everything, and this is all competitive, at least it used to be competitive, in that back in my day, literally 30, 40,000 people would take this exam, which will come out like every 3 or 4 years.
Wow.
And they would take about the top 10% of that graduated and then put you through the following tests. So it was very competitive in that, you know, they were trying to get the best recruit possible. All right. And then you go through the academy and you become a beat cop and get sent to wherever it is that you're going to work. Now, back in my time too, we would take different exams because there was the NYPD, the police department, but there was also the transit police and the housing police. Everything was separate.
Okay.
And I was lucky enough that I got called and went to the NYPD. When I say that, just because I prefer the NYPD to the transit or housing.
Yeah.
And but now when Mayor Giuliani came in, he said, this is ridiculous. Why do we have three different police departments, and created one giant police department? So although there is still a transit bureau that handles the transit department and a housing bureau, it's all under one umbrella and people can move around within it. Back to your original question. So yeah, I had taken the test when I was a teenager, and then I had taken them all. I had taken the housing, the transit, the NYPD test, the fire department test. I even took a building inspector's test because I had that survey thing in there. So it was something that I could put on the list. You know, again, I'm looking for a civil service job. And I got called. And at first, what had happened, when I came out of the Army, I had worked in a couple of nightclubs, just an interesting side note. And I got put on character review because when working in these nightclubs, some were owned by, you know, disreputable people. You know, New York, this is New York City and nightclubs are big money. And they put me on character review for like 2 years. It took them to decide I was not a bad guy because I wasn't. I had never committed any crimes. I wasn't mixed up with organized crime by any means. But I did work for businesses that were owned by disreputable types.
So character review is sort of a probationary period where they're kind of watching you or...
Well, it's part of your investigation. So, you know, you don't know what they're doing, but when you apply, you're assigned an investigator who investigates you. And for the most part, we're all young men and women, so we don't have much of a history anyway.
Yeah.
But, you know, they want to make sure, you know, well, silly things now, like you can see, I am tattooed. At the time, I probably had 4, even though I have quite a few more than that now. But I had to write a one sheet paper on why I got each tattoo, because back then it made a difference. They wanted to make sure you weren't crazy, you weren't gang affiliated, you weren't whatever.
Yeah.
And it just things like this to check on your character. Because again, you want to have
the best of the best. Yeah.
Well, that's the idea. Yeah. You know, well, the best of the people that are applying at least. And so, yes, I got held up in character review, but then I ended up getting hired. That was it. You know, I was a young police officer. I was assigned to the 5-2 precinct in the Bronx. And I worked there for, I don't know, about 5 years before I got picked up by narcotics. Mm-hmm. And I did several different jobs within the 5-2 in that interim time. Let me back up a little bit so your listeners understand kind of what's going on. You have the patrol track, okay, which is your uniform track, all right? And then you have an investigatory track, which are detectives. While I was on patrol, there are still different units, some of which are not uniformed. One of which was SNU, the Street Narcotics Enforcement Unit, which is a precinct-only narcotics unit within the precinct. I was on that for a year. Then I went to anti-crime, and anti-crime is we dress exactly how you and I are dressed right now, just your regular street clothes, and you go out, and basically you're looking, the biggest thing you're doing is looking for gun arrests. You're looking to get guns off the street. You drive around your precinct to unmarked cars and plain clothes and stop people and, you know, the old stop and frisk and see, you know, just what you can find. And I did that for about a year also before going to narcotics. But the bulk of my career was done in narcotics itself, Bronx Narcotics Division. And then, of course, when I was in SNU in the precinct. So narcotics was the vast majority of my work.
Was it scary your first day going out there, either with a partner or on your own and making an arrest? Like, how
I have
did that
to say,
feel?
Not so much for me. I mean, I know a lot of people are not built for this sort of work, especially in the Bronx. The Bronx is a completely different world than most people know, good and bad. I mean, I love the Bronx, but the bad parts are bad and crazy bad. And it's a very different culture than most people are used to. So for myself, being a New York City kid to begin with, I knew how to talk to people. I knew how to be around people. It didn't affect me. For people maybe who were, you know, coming from Long Island or upstate, when I say upstate, you know, you're only allowed to move so far, but, you know, the one or two counties above, the suburban kids, it probably was more of a culture shock for them. You know?
And that shows, like, when you get a police officer from the neighborhood that knows the neighborhood or knows the city, it works out better because...
Well, it can... Yeah. It can, but that kind of comes down to personality, too. I know many, many, many of these suburban men and women who really are fantastic police officers. That's because they have the heart for it and they have the intelligence for it. When I say these things, I'm not knocking them. But as far as your you know, was I afraid? Well, I went to one of the worst performing high schools in New York City. You know, that's one of the reasons I dropped out so early. It was a ridiculous place to work. If you ever want to look it up, look up Julia Richmond High School on your Wikipedia. You know, it was a 37% graduation rate.
Wow.
You know, and the local police used to call it Julia Rikers after Rikers Island because it was such a ridiculous place. And it was a ridiculous place to go to school. We actually had cages downstairs in the in where the guidance counselors were and the principals were. They had two cages where they would lock up the bad kids for the day. They'd put you in a cell, you know.
Kid jail in high school.
It was jail in high school. It absolutely was. It was a wild place. So for me, and not to sound like a tough guy, but being a rough and tumble street kid, working in the Bronx was just a step in a different direction for me. Yeah. I was not necessarily afraid. That was your question. Was I afraid? No. There is an odd thing when you first go out there, though, because it's kind of like, have you ever bartended before?
No, but I've worked in restaurants.
All right. Well, bartending, I'll tell a young bartender, same thing I'll tell a young cop. It's the closest thing almost to being a movie star that a regular guy gets. And what do I mean by that? When you're all of a sudden standing on the corner and you're in uniform, all eyes are on you. When you're sitting behind the bar, especially the first time you don't know it and you have 100 people on the other side of the bar, all eyes are on you. You are the personality for the day, you know, and everybody notices you. And love you or hate you, it's the same on the street when you're in uniform. Everybody, all eyes are on you. Everybody knows you're there. And that's an interesting thing to go from a regular person who's completely unnoticed to the person that everybody notices, if that makes sense.
Yeah, being a celebrity podcaster, I kind of catch on to what you're saying. I feel it.
I'm sure you do, especially the thing like CrimeCon where, you know, literally 1,000 people know your name. Yeah, you know, and weird. You don't know any of them.
No, because I, like you, was not the best kid, probably the least likely to succeed, never had any attention, never was popular. And then I come to CrimeCon with my podcast and everybody wants to meet me. All eyes are on me. It's a weird feeling.
Well, let me tell you something there, Justin. For us with the book thing, which we can talk about later on, the books that we do now, and that's why we're doing podcasts and things like that. Yeah. For me and my sister, we did our first book completely as a goof. You know, we're older now. It was just before COVID had hit. And we just had this idea, you know, hey, let's do a book together. And she was like, yeah, we'll do it. And we wrote it. And out of sheer luck, the thing took off like a shot. And then the second one came out, the third one came out, the fourth one, the fifth one's going to be coming out this year. But we started getting fan mail. People cared about us. And I mean, from Australia, from Ireland, from London, from places I've never heard of, people are writing in. And you're like, what is this? Yeah. You know? And then the first time it happened to me, I was in a diner and a guy's looking at me. You know when people are looking at you, right? And he says, you're that guy, right? And I'm like, I don't know. Where are you going with that?
Depends on the context.
Right? And I was like, hell yeah, I write the books. Sit down, pal. Let's talk. And it was just the wildest thing to me. Now, we certainly don't have fans when I'm walking down the street. I have people like, oh, let me get your autograph. Yeah. But it shocks me that people give a shit about me at all or even have the slightest inkling who I am. In CrimeCon, the first time we did CrimeCon was last year. And I couldn't believe how many people knew who we were.
Yeah.
And wanted our autograph and bought books and and bought our stuff. It was amazing. Amazing.
That's awesome. So you transferred to narcotics. Is that a whole different beast than regular patrol and everything else?
Absolutely.
The crack epidemic was kind of going on at that point.
Well, that's part of why I got in actually so young on the job. Mm-hmm. There was a time that usually a detective usually had 8 to 10 years on a job before he had made his bones, so to speak, to really, you know, to be a detective. But there was a giant initiative because crack had just changed the world so much. It was always a lot of drugs, a lot of problems in New York City. And so, there was a big push. And in fact, the Bronx Narcotics became the largest command in the city. All right. And when I say that, a command is like a precinct. So it was its own entity, Bronx Narcotics. And we had like maybe 380 guys. Where your average precinct, would only have 150 to 180 guys in that neighborhood. All right. It was a whole different world, a different way to work. The worst part about working narcotics, I actually like narcotics. In fact, knowing what, squad detectives go through, squad detectives are like your NYPD Blue Sipowitz guys. All right. And they're the guys that get everything from, the simplest theft with a known perp or domestic violence thing, all the way up to the big one being homicide. And everything in between is what a squad detective has to do. And he could literally have 100 cases on his desk. If you work in a busy house, you've got a lot of stuff coming in. You could have 100 cases that you got to get through. And they don't stop coming, and they don't go away. So at the end of your shift, It's still there tomorrow. It's still there the next day until it's over. And in narcotics, and I'm not knocking on my brothers and sisters in narcotics, all right? But, you know, the detecting is pretty easy. Either they're selling drugs or they're not. And that's it. And we used to have, in fact, when the complaints would come in, we used to call them kites. And a kite was, the joke was you could fold it up into a paper airplane and throw it out the window because it doesn't make any difference. The complaints were certainly not victimless complaints. Yeah. But again, either they're selling drugs or they're not. And if they were selling drugs there for 4 hours yesterday, it doesn't mean they're going to be selling drugs there today. You know, yeah. So you're constantly chasing them. And back to the worst part about narcotics that I was going to get to were the hours because of that. Just because of what I had described is you have to work on whatever information you have and the way the bad guys are working at the time. So if you are a family man, which I was, I had, you know, a young wife and, you know, two very, very young children, and your boss, your sergeant, your boss is your sergeant, right? Says, okay, well, we're going to work 6 at night till 2 in the morning today, but we're all going to come back at 9 o'clock tomorrow. And then you're going to come back again for 4 to 12 the next day. But the next day we're going to do a midnight because we're chasing these guys. We have information on this. We have information on that. Or our complaints quite often would come up from, you know, the higher ups who say, look, we're having a lot of problems. Like a lot of times too, there was so much drugs in New York City and particularly the Bronx that our drug activity would follow wherever the local homicides were going. Why? Because the more drug dealers and drug addicts we could scoop up in this area could lead to information to homicides.
Yeah.
So you kind of want to hit, you know, high priority targets, if you will, or high priority areas. And so we were bouncing around like a pinball machine, just bing, 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 bing. We were all over the place. And with that, we'd probably go out and do like buy and bust operations, possibly 3 times a week, because the rest of the time you're in court. You know, yeah. People don't think of that either. When we go out as a team, grab up literally 10, 15 guys, sometimes 20 people, you know, bad guys in a night doing a buy and bust operation, pack that van as full as we can, bring them in, process them. Well, now the arresting officer, the undercovers, all those guys are lost to court because they have to go for arraignments. They have to go to the grand jury, et cetera, et cetera. And once you have a couple of months of this in, you're going to court every week.
Yeah. You know, yeah.
Because it just adds up.
That's something that I talk about a lot on my podcast is everybody says we need more funding. We need more funding. And that seems to always just translate more patrol police, more detectives. And I'm like, we need more funding for the courts. We need more funding for evidence testing. We need more personnel to go to court to actually testify, you know, against people. I mean, there's so many different aspects to it. And I feel like people get very, you know, they get the blinders on. They just think,
well, I agree with you. And on my end, from a guy who, and granted, I've been gone for 20 years now, but in my end, you need more money and more personnel and more quality personnel in every aspect.
Yeah.
You see, the bad part, and again, now
you don't have to disclaimer. You're good.
No, I'm not going to disclaimer. I just want to make sure I'm getting my words right before I spit them at you.
No problem.
A big problem that we have just in general, well, with the word law enforcement and the police department itself, I mean, right from the chiefs, the commissioners, whoever the boss is where you live, right down to the newest recruit. We are the lowest rung on the law enforcement ladder, so much so that I will even say we, the police, shouldn't even be called law enforcement because we don't get to enforce shit. We don't enforce anything. Yeah. It goes to the court for enforcement. You also have a problem where the court people, the ADAs, assistant district attorneys, quite often they are the lowest rung on the ladder, attorney class.
Legal because system.
Because they're the lowest paid. It's the least attractive job. You know, and I'm not knocking these kids at all. Believe me, I'm not. But they got to start somewhere. Yeah. And if they can't get into a good private practice place, if they don't have an uncle or a father or a mother or somebody that can hook them up with a really good job, you know what? Or they don't graduate top of their class, they're going to work there. And they are so overworked, especially in big cities. Well, like you yourself, you come from Kansas City, correct?
Yeah. Yeah.
Kansas City, as you know, because you live there, you should know, it is basically the size of Boston. It's a big city. I mean, the rest of the country may not know this. That's why I'm going to paint it. Yeah. But also, if I'm not mistaken, you guys are like always in the top 10 to top 20 cities as far as violent crime.
Yeah. St. Louis is always in the top 5.
Oh, St. Louis is a crazy place.
Yeah. And in the 90s, Kansas City and St. Louis were always in the top five. But since 1995, Kansas City's gotten a lot better. But we're always in the top 10. I mean, obviously.
Well, yes. Yeah. But, you know, out of the hundreds and hundreds of cities that we have in America, it's shameful that that's the case. So anyway, you know, people immediately want to beat up on the police. Oh, the police aren't doing their job. They'll say that it always comes down to the police because, again, we are the lowest rung on the ladder. And here's where I am somewhat defending the police departments because, yeah, they're just regular men and women going out to try to get through their day, get some bad guys, hopefully help somebody. Yeah. You know, that's why the majority of people go into this work, right? And then it's dropped off to the court system, which again has, for the most part, very young attorneys, inexperienced attorneys, right out of law school attorneys, and or attorneys that never left for something better, okay? And then the biggest problem outside of funding that all cities have, and this is not a political left or right statement, it's just a simple fact, is that whatever problems you're having in Kansas City or I'm having in New York City or we're having in any other municipality anywhere comes down to the mayor, not the president. Fuck the president. I could give a shit who to be. Most of these presidents I have no use for whatsoever. Fuck all of them. All right. Your mayors, though, have all the power to correct whatever is going on in your city. And if you have a bad city, if you have a crime problem and it doesn't get corrected, it should be laid in their lap. And sadly, we all keep electing mayors who don't care, They're more worried about big galas that they're going to go on or getting reelected, or reelection is the biggest problem we have with politicians. But then it's almost like a celebrity status for them that they're more interested in rather than actually getting down and dirty and fixing problems.
I think the saying is, I want to go in there and clean up this cesspool. But once you get there, you realize it's a hot tub.
Yeah, exactly.
You know.
Yeah. I like that. And it is. It's a filthy mess. And so, again, it sounds like I'm not beating up on the police. I'm not beating up on the district attorney's office. I am absolutely beating up on our mayors. They have the ability to do it. They don't have the will.
And even if you are a little jaded or beating up on police or attorneys, it's not, you're not hating the player. You're hating the game. And it's not set up very efficiently, or it's gone downhill since at least you've served your time as a police officer. But there's always problems. There's always improvements to be made. And that's, I guess, always at the heart of what I try to do is, like, we can always be improving. We could always be doing better. And I don't know how or why things go the way they go. I don't have the answers, but it takes other perspectives. You know, we can't just be on the outside looking in going, I hate this system. Well, why don't we talk to people that are in the system and see what they think and see where things Absolutely. Could have been changed, you know?
Well, here's the thing that I find so often too. So, I mean, right now we are in this information superhighway that we live in where we're so flooded with mostly nonsense all the time. But we'll have our bullshit pundits on TV. Oh, fellas like yourself, you know, have a podcast going on, you know, who have opinions, and many of your opinions, not that they're not valid, but are, and well, I'm not talking about you personally, but you know, they're not valid, but they are ignorant, and ignorant is not a bad word. I'm not saying somebody's stupid. I'm saying, no, you have no clue what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Like there was I remember a guy telling me one time, an older fella, we were talking about cops and police stuff. And he said, the funny thing about, the New York City Police Department, but I'm sure this would work for any police department in the world, okay, is that for a young recruit, doing the job will turn, for lack of a better word, because this is how we said it, a Nazi into a liberal and a liberal into a Nazi. And what do I mean by that? You're banged up with so much of the just awful things that you see day after day after day after day. Anything that you thought, you know, it could turn a devout religious person to an atheist, or an atheist may find God. You see what I'm saying? It's probably the closest thing to actual combat. Now, I was not a combat guy when I was in the army, all right, that people will see. And you're just so inundated with the bullshit and more bullshit, that it will twist your thoughts and hopefully enlighten you, okay, into seeing the good where there is good and, of course, condemning the bad where there's bad.
What were some of the scariest times for you?
Scariest times. A lot of times, to be honest, Justin, the things happen so quick that you're not afraid. Now, don't get me wrong. You know, when you're out there and you're doing things, you know, the kind of thing where you're doing, like, what was that movie, Seven, if you remember Seven? And, you know, you go into a building and you know it's a scary building. It's a scary, scary place, you know, and it's just you and your partner. And you're going up those stairs for a gun run, for a homicide. You're chasing drug dealers. You assume they may have guns. And you can't see anything. You don't know where you're going, you know, or you go down literally a dark alley. You know, your heart's pounding out of your chest, but you charge on because it's what you do. So those things are, I guess, yes, they're scary. I mean, thank God I was never shot, but I've been shot at. Scary thing when it happens. Funny thing, though, a little brief story with that. One time when I was in narcotics, myself and I was driving a sergeant that day, Sergeant Hayes, real good guy. I like working with him. And we had heard just shots going off. Had nothing to do with our buy and bust. We start driving real slow down the block. And sure enough, we drive right in the middle of it. The whole place was mayhem. Guys, people are running all, even though it's like, you know, 1 o'clock in the morning. This is the Bronx. Okay. We hop out of the car and I say, that's the guy. This one kid is cool as a cucumber. I said, that's our guy, because he's in control of the situation. Right. And as soon as we get out of the car, he turns and fires at us. Right. The bullet zips right between our two heads. And we take off after him. And again, all the right rights in the world to shoot this kid dead because he's shooting at us. What did I do? I chased him down. He tried to get rid of the gun by throwing it into an alley, but it bounced off the iron gates, dropped onto the staircase. I got him, locked him up, took him back. And that was it. End of story. Those things, yes, they're frightening, but they happen so unbelievably fast that, you know, it's over before you know it. Doing warrants, when you go and do a warrant, and I've done dozens of warrants, especially when I was in narcotics, but in SNU also, and you go to take the door, you know, you get up, but it's a thrilling fear. It's not, again, it's not for everybody. Some people are like, man, I don't know how you do this narcotic shit. They can't do it. But when it's me and you, you know, and four other guys, and we know they're in there, and we know they got drugs, and we know they got guns, and we know who they are, and we know that they're bad guys, and we're getting up there, it's maybe, you know, 9 o'clock in the morning, as early as we can get in there, because we want to get them in their underwear if we can. And I got that ram and I look back at you and I give you a wink. Are you ready, Justin? And you're like, yep. Man, your heart is beating out of your chest.
Yeah.
And boom, 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 you take the door and you go in and you clear room after room after room. If you're not scared, there's something wrong with you. But it's not scary the way people think of scary. Yeah. Does that make sense to you?
Absolutely.
I mean, your military training might have done that for you too. You know, I mean, maybe the first time you had to rappel. Rappelling is scary shit. I like jumping better than rappelling, believe it or not.
Yeah.
You know, because jumping, I could just go and it's over. But rappelling, I'm in control. I got that rope. So yeah, if that answers your question, there's things, scary things. Okay. Things that bother you, scary, missing children. Mm-hmm. Okay. I have a quote in the one that I'll never forget. Oh, I got choked up for a half a second there. I'm sorry. What do you call it? Because kids will just always fuck with you, you know?
Yeah.
And I got a quote from Sergeant Dolan, who was a real police officer that I used to know. When a child goes missing, the whole world stops. And I put that in the preface of our second book because it's true. And that is really stuff, because you get mixed up with missing people, you know, real good, decent, hardworking people. A lot of times in the drug world, to tell you the truth, you don't have a lot of sympathy because this is the life that they chose. You know, they're doing what they choose to do. And I can give disclaimers there because I do understand drug dealing. I understand, like myself, if I was a poor kid and I had to feed myself, I would sell drugs. I understand that. And when you have a missing child, oh my God, man, that is a scary thing to deal with. It's a hard thing to deal with. And even though, thank God, most of them tend to be found because they tend to be lost before something awful happens. Quite often it is something awful that happens, and that's something that it's on you, man. You're the guy that's coming to save the day. And if you don't, even though you didn't commit the crime, it's going to be something you're going to have on your shoulders for the rest of your life.
And you know, if you don't find that child quickly, just that time, each passing minute, you know something terrible has probably happened.
Well, the statistics, and I'm sure this changes, all right, because again, it's been so long since I was actually working, but it's something ridiculous, like 80% of people who are abducted are usually dead within the first 3 hours. 3 hours is not a lot of time, you know? And it's because usually when they're abducted, you know, for sexual purposes, and then they're killed. and or they're abducted to be killed. But the abduction thing, that's a really bad, scary spot to be. Yeah, that's an awful thing to deal with.
When it came to you going from narcotics to being a detective, was that one and the same? Are you?
Well, it was one and the same. What do you call it? I became a detective in narcotics. So we have an 18-month bill, and once you do narcotic work for 18 months, you become a detective. I did a little work before that, but I ended up going to narcotics instead with a RIP, which was a robbery identification program within the precinct, which I loved. I actually got to work with my brother Henry there for a little while, which was very fun, going out to work with a guy. We have a very strange relationship just because we were street kids together, you know, ran around, went to school together. We ran around with all the different characters from the neighborhood together. Then we went in the Army, and we were separate. We were separated at the Army at first because we went on different dates. But we both went to airborne school and landed on Fort Bragg. Mm-hmm. And I went to my first sergeant, Sergeant Tommy Gunn. I never forget him. And I said, listen, they stuck my brother in a leg unit. Now, if you remember from being in the Army, a leg is a non-airborne personnel, right? Yeah. And so he said, really? And he's airborne qualified? So they went and they grabbed him and brought him into my unit. So we actually got to jump together. And, you know, he slept like three doors down from me. It was just the craziest story. And then he ended up getting into the police department first before I did. He went to the 5-2 precinct. Bang, I landed in the 5-2 precinct with him. Mm-hmm. And then even though we were separated, I would do things for patrol when he was a detective and it would get mixed up. Then I went to the RIP where I got to work with him. And it was a really, really nice, just nice experiences to have.
Yeah. And it makes you be protective of your brother, your fellow police officers when you have this connection. And when you do go through that door, you know that you're doing this to make sure everyone comes out safely and you're protecting them. It's this camaraderie. A lot of people don't understand, or they might feel that in a regular civilian life, but until you're going through something really intense, you don't understand like how much you form a bond through.
Well, there are things like that. And this subject has come up, well, it's come up in life, but on these podcasts and things like this too, where, in fact, I recently had a conversation with my son, Nikki, who is kind of on the outs, was one of his best friends when he was a kid. And I tried to say, listen, you're never going to make the friends that you had going through junior high school and high school again. Yeah. These friends, you know, because you can't lie to each other. You know each other. You can't be phonies because you know each other your entire lives. Cherish these friendships. Some people have that in college. Military, you make military friends. I have friends even now from the military who I almost never talk to. But when 9/11 happened, my phone was ringing off the hook from people that I knew from years before, just trying to find out if I was okay. And same with the police department. And the same, I mean, I've been out of the police department for 20 years. I have many friends still from the police department. Sadly, I still, you know, with this, because of 9/11, a whole nother subject, you know, I go to funerals all the time for guys who are dropping dead from the cancer and that shit, you know.
Knowing how to speak and understand a new language can be an invaluable tool when traveling, meeting new friends, or just even to master a new skill. But it's not always simple when you're bogged down by textbooks and structure classes. That's why so many people trust Rosetta Stone. Rosetta Stone is the most trusted language learning program, available on desktop or as an app. It truly immerses you in the language you want to learn, like Spanish, French, Italian, Chinese, and more. You won't just be studying English translations. The Rosetta Stone intuitive process helps you pick up a language naturally, first with words, then phrases, then sentences. Don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/rs10. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/rs10 today.
And, but you never make friends like that. And, so yes, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, and I want to ask you about 9/11. This is a perfect segue to it. You had been retired from the police force. Yeah, and 9/11 happens, and you just put on your shoes and walk down the street and walk towards the situation, right?
Correct. Yep.
I mean, you're a citizen now.
Yes, but I had to.
Yeah.
You know, I explained that to you. Like, well, my wife, I remember my wife coming home. The day it happened, when 9/11 happened, on 9/11, I was actually working a security job. I was making a TV commercial. Sounds really cool. I worked for this company that made music videos and TV commercials, but it was another boring job.
Yeah.
I sat in the corner. You know, I was the guy that made sure people didn't steal things or didn't disrupt the set. So I had done an overnight and I was driving home when all of it happened. I didn't even know what happened because I was listening to, you know, cassettes or CDs in the car, or whatever it was. I drove all the way home. My goal was to get in bed, get some sleep so I can get up and get my kids off the school bus when they were done with school. Right. And sure enough, you know, I go to sleep and I get up and my, you know, the phone was blinking because I had all the messages. And I'm like, what the hell is happening? I turn on the TV. I cannot believe it. My wife came home at, you know, her usual time, 5:30, whatever it was, when she was done working for the dentist that she worked for. And that was it. I said, honey, I got to go. I have to go. I can't stay here. I mean, I was so nervous. I was like almost breaking out in a sweat. What the hell is going on? And yeah, I made my way down to the World Trade Center. But I ended up working in one of the four temporary morgues that were there. Because we had a doctor, a couple of civilians that were just people, you know, volunteers and a nurse. And they'd bring us the bodies. Or what? Out of the 86 bodies I processed, there was only one body. Everything else were parts and bits and pieces. And some stuff was absolutely unrecognizable. And I would catalog what it all was, you know. And I would male white with a beard, gray T-shirt with blue letters on it. You know, I can't read what your shirt says here because it's half cut off. But I would write all of this stuff down. So that somewhere down the line, maybe one of your loved ones could say, that's what my husband was wearing. That's what my son was wearing. Whatever it was, we would just catalog everything that we could. And so I did that for the first 5 days. Yes, sir.
Did that change you?
It changed me. So I get this question a lot when it comes to police work and the military and 9/11. I don't suffer from PTSD because that's where everybody's going, if that's what you're going to say. I don't feel that I do. Okay. That being said, people may argue with me. I know when I go down to the 9/11 program that I do once a year, I get a checkup with them and you always have to get tested in. They always want to ask you your mental state. And yeah, you know, when 9/11 comes around or when I tell the story, sure, I'll get a tear in my eye. You know what I'm saying? If it's on TV, I turn it off. I don't want to watch it. I don't want to say I was there. It was a very sad, scary, miserable experience. At the same time, it's one that, looking back, I wouldn't trade in. It's a thing for people that do a lot of awful things. Is, can I say it makes me a better man? I don't know. I don't know if that's really what I want to say, but I had to do it. I don't think I could have, you know, obviously if it happened in California, I wouldn't have gone to California to do it. You know what I'm saying? But this was my city. It was my home. I had to be there. And it wasn't even a matter of saving people because there was nobody to save. When you hear people tell stories about people being saved and rescued, they're full of shit. It didn't happen. It was over within literally not minutes, but hours. Everybody that was gone was gone. There was no recovering people from the collect. The temperatures were so high. I mean, the stuff that we were finding was just, it was all gone.
Everyone referred to it as the pile, right?
It was a massive pile. It was like it was a nine, basically, we did the math one day and I could be off, but it was like a nine square block pile. Cause it was like, you know, 3 blocks by 3 blocks in the highest point made possibly, I don't know, 80, 100 feet high. I couldn't tell you. Cause it was, you know, it was the Twin Towers, you know, all folded up onto all these buildings folded up on top of each other. It was a really wild, surreal scene. When I first showed up to that scene and I had to get a ride. You couldn't get downtown. I got a ride with the National Guard. I went to the armory and, you know, you couldn't take the subways. You couldn't take everything. We were shut down. And I got on a truck with some National Guard guys. They didn't want to let me on, but then I still had my shield with me. I tinned them, actually my dupe, because we're not allowed to carry shields anymore. Okay. And it took me down there. I walked from Battery Park, which is the very bottom of the city where the Staten Island Ferry is. And I walked like the 3 or 4 blocks up to where it was. And the ash was like up to your ankles, like snow, you know. And they had taken all of the cars that had immediately been stuck because no cars couldn't go anywhere. So, you know, I don't know if it was a city or construction workers or whatever came through with the big machines and picked up all the cars and stacked them on top of each other on either side. So it really was like some futuristic movie, you know, where you're walking through this tunnel of cars because the cars are 2 and 3 high on each side. And this ash, which is on everything, you know, at that time was literally coming over the tops of my boots and up to my ankles in some spots. It was a wild, wild scene.
And you're a New Yorker, so this is very personal to you, but
absolutely.
Everyone talks about the first responders, but there were people, just regular citizens like yourself, that were just pouring in and helping out here.
All kinds of people. Well, like for myself, I was the only, well, in fact, I was technically a civilian anyway, but in my morgue, beautiful thing. When I say beautiful, like on other podcasts too, people are like, beautiful? 9/11, beautiful? What are you talking about? It was a beautiful sight to see when I first got there. It was still dark, probably short about midnight, 1 o'clock in the morning, whenever it was. And there's this just giant pile of refuse that used to be the Twin Towers. But there's lights all over the place because there were 1,000 people climbing all over this place, all over this thing, trying to help other people. And then the lieutenant at the THV, that's the temporary headquarters vehicle, he was the one that directed me. He says, I don't need you over here. I have too many people to do this. Too many people is not a bad problem to have. No. Okay. He says, but I could use you at the morgue because I got nobody of any sort of authority over there. It was all civilians. It was all, again, it was a doctor that got stuck there. There was a nurse that got stuck there. We had this beautiful girl and her boyfriend came over from Staten Island. Oh, let me take a breath for a second here. Mm-hmm. And she came over, and when she got off the ferry, they sent her back. They said, you can't come. We don't need anybody. And you're basically of no use to us because you're like a 19-year-old nobody, right? She went back and she put on her mother's scrubs and came back and pretended she was a medical professional. And she ended up landing in the morgue with me. And now what could she do? Well, there's nothing to do anyway. Everybody's dead, right? Yeah. But she humped the bodies just like everybody else. She picked up the bag. She opened the bag. She closed the bags. We did everything that we did. A lot of times we would have the bags. So they wouldn't even be in the bags. They would bring the bodies or parts to us and, you know, wrapped up in trash bags. We'd put them in bags. It was just a really grim, gruesome, nasty thing. All of this was in the lobby of the Brooks Brothers. If you know what Brooks Brothers is, it's menswear for like rich Wall Street guys. So we have all these racks of clothes we pushed out of the way and just, you know, a stack of body bags up against the wall. It was a very strange thing to be. I don't know if I went off track there because I can't remember exactly what you asked me.
No.
And it was a wild, civilians, yes.
Yeah.
And so I'll give credit here where credit's due that a lot of people don't realize. Everybody wants to pat the police department, the fire department on their on the back for all the work that we did there, and especially now when everybody's dying of this awful cancer shit. But what they don't remember are all the construction guys that were down there, all right? And all just regular people, too, that were showing. Now, that as the days went on, they started to weed them out because they didn't want to have, one, another terror attack. They wanted to know who these people were, so they cordoned off the area. Mm-hmm. So you couldn't get in at all anymore. At first, anybody could walk in, people were going by on skateboards when I first showed up. That was that crazy, right? But yeah, people forget about the construction workers. You know, the guys that are up there, however many feet in the air, cutting through steel, running the big equipment, those aren't cops. Those aren't firemen. The heavy equipment operators, they're all civilians. And they were there for months pulling all that stuff apart. And then, of course, for the cops, what got most of the cops later on was having to go out to the Fresh Kills landfill and sort through all this refuse for months afterwards. So for months, you know, you think it's bad to be down there for a few days and breathe that shit. You're doing it for months.
Yeah.
Because you have to keep going out again. You might not go every day, but week after week, month after month, you're getting sent to Fresh Kills to sort through stuff looking for remains. It was a ridiculous situation.
I can't imagine a more gruesome or apocalyptic scene, but just the fact that so many people came together is like the silver lining of, you know, I'm sure even not just in New York, but across America, everyone got along for a day. Everyone just shut up and just, you know, how was it in New York?
One of those things that I love so much. What do the young people call them? A meme. And the meme was, I wish every day was September 12th. And it was such a beautiful thing. And of course, you know, so many people now don't even remember 9/11 anymore. I know it wasn't that long ago. But, you know, if you're 30 years old, You know, you were 4 years old when it happened. You don't remember that shit. It was not part of your life. And especially if you weren't a New Yorker, you know, really, it really wasn't. So a lot of people really have no grasp of what the country was like at the time. But anyway, I was there for like 5 days. And when I had left, I walked up to where my mother was working because she worked for the Oprah Winfrey Network. Nothing fancy. She was accounts payable. She paid the bills. All right. But the floor, she didn't have an office, but you know, where all the cubicles and all this stuff are, she looked out and could see the where the Twin Towers were from where her office was. And I walked, it was up in Chelsea Market. So I'm not sure exactly what street, like 17th, 18th Street, something like that. So I walked up there and I picked her up and we took the bus home together. And after I dropped her off, because I was going to catch the train home, and there were some bad, when I say bad guys, I'm a police officer. I'm a New York City guy. I know what bad guys are, right? Now you got to picture me. I'm covered in all this white dust. I haven't slept properly or ate properly for the last 5 days. And actually, we did eat fairly well because, I mean, restaurant people came out. Again, let me give credit to the restaurant people, too. You got so much free food down there. They had like, they set up like a little food court on the street, if you will. And everything from McDonald's to steaks you could have for free because you were working. And these people did it out of the goodness of their heart. Take what you want. Take as much as you want. It was a really good scene. But anyway, so I'm passing these bad guys, if you will. It's like three of these jokers hanging out in the corner. And they looked at me. And it wasn't the, we know you're on the job, even though I was already retired. But, you know, when you're a cop, you look like a cop, right? We know you're on the job. We know you're for lack of a better word, the enemy. Guy looked at me, he winked and said, thank you. And that hit me pretty hard, man. And then on that same ride home, I got on the train and again, I'm filthy and I'm sitting down and, but all of seats face one way except for the front. So I'm sitting there on the end and I'm just like pretty exhausted, got my head leaning back, you know, I'm going to go home. And very nice, well-to-do prep school, college girl, lives somewhere in Westchester, very nice lady, right? And she's sitting across from me and she reaches over and puts her hand on my knee. Doesn't say a word. And that meant the world to me too. And then of course, my beautiful Christine, my wife, she fucking kicked me in the teeth because as soon as I got home, you know, we had just bought our first house a couple of years before. I got home and what do I got? It was an older Civil War era house, right? In Brewster, New York. We had a big long front porch. Kind of shit we city kids dream about, you know, it was really nice. Well, it actually wasn't nice. It was a really banged up old haunted house. But anyway, it was a cool old fashioned house, right? Yeah. And she had this giant, like not a little regular 5 foot American flag, but one that was like maybe 8 feet wide, hung up on it with candles going all the way. I couldn't cross the street. I had to stand there and cry for a minute, get it out of my system before I crossed the street. And then, of course, I got in there and I hugged and kissed her and I hugged and kissed my kids like I never did it before. And that's something that I try to tell people too. All right. So, you know, your listeners that are listening now, if I could tell you anything, the handful of people that you really love in your life, grab them by the face and look them in the eye and tell them that you really love them. Because tomorrow it could be you or it could be them or some other god awful tragedy. It doesn't have to be crime. It could be a tornado. It could be an accidental drowning. It could be a heart attack. It could be a slip in the bathtub. It could be the most innocuous, silly thing in the world could happen. And you're always going to hate yourself for not hugging them and kissing them and loving them. And there you go. So if I could say anything, I'll give you that. And that's not crime related. That's life related.
I lost my older brother in 2004. And then I lost my sister to fentanyl a couple years ago. Yeah. And I wasn't close with my brother, but I was trying to help my sister out. I was trying to be there for her and support her. And I don't have any regrets because I know I tried to treat her well before she died. I know that I was doing my best for her. And with my brother, I was estranged from him. We hadn't spoken in years when he died. So kind of helped me because I didn't grieve his passing because he was already out of my life. But sister hit pretty hard, but I don't have any regrets about my own actions, you know?
Well, a lot of people do, like, you know, my mother passed last February, right? Not this February that just passed, but last February. Okay. And oddly enough, she died on my birthday of all days. Okay. But she died of Alzheimer's And there's no other way to say it. I was happy that she finally went, you know, because it was just an awful way to live. I hated watching her slowly rot away to where she was, to where she actually passed. Now, for us, because we could afford to do it, you know, again, I'm not patting myself on the back at all. Please understand that. But we made sure she was with us. I built her in, I have a walkout basement, so it's not like it's a basement. I built her a nice little efficiency apartment down there where, you know, she had everything she needed. You know, she lived with us through, you know, the last year of her life. And luckily for us and for her and for everybody involved, it did go fairly quickly. You know, some people have Alzheimer's for 15 years, you know. Luckily for her, she had it for several years, but the bad part was the last year, and she was with us the entire time. Honestly say, I could not have done much more for my mother, and yet I still feel guilty. You know, why didn't I do more of this? Why didn't I sit with her more? Why didn't I whatever? Because you just can't help it. There's nothing you can do about that. So, but you know, grief is a funny thing, and you know, however it manifests itself. So yeah, it's a sad. I'm very sorry for your losses, especially for you. Were both of them younger?
No, I'm the youngest.
You're the youngest.
Yeah. I'm an only child. It's weird.
That fentanyl shit too is such an awful thing. Yeah, yeah. It's such an awful. Drugs in general, you know, my life being spent in doing narcotics work, you know, my police life anyway, and doing so much of it. Drugs really does just, it ravages families, it ravages neighborhoods. And now at this stage of the game, it's literally ravaging the country.
Yeah.
Because this fentanyl is such an insidious, awful thing. And these fuckers that are doing it to us too, stick it in things. I don't know what happened with your sister. I had a very good friend. In fact, a singer from a band called Two Fisted Law. If you don't know them, a really good band out of Connecticut. Big Jim was a professional wrestler, a big, strong guy. And he was taking things that he thought were painkillers, and it had fentanyl in it. Killed him dead. He wouldn't have done that fentanyl on purpose. You know, he was a big, giant bodybuilding nut job, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, sure. He fooled around with drugs and he drank and he partied because he was a rock and roller, but he would have never touched that stuff if he thought it was going to kill him.
It's so weird because back in the day, people would cut drugs with baking powder or aspirin. Yeah. They would fill it with benign things. And now they cut it with the most extreme, powerful opiate.
Yeah.
And I will never understand it. I absolutely will not understand how fentanyl is cheaper than cutting something with aspirin. It just doesn't
I think a lot of times it comes down to the cheap high though too. Fentanyl is very inexpensive.
Yeah.
When I was a kid, I used to hang out with the local drug dealers on our street there. They were part of our little crew, right? And they were very small time street rat hoods, you know. But they used to make me laugh because they, you know, marijuana, of course, was always the biggest, most popular thing, right? Still is, I'm sure. So they would get it and they put it out on the kitchen table and they spread it all out, all this marijuana, pound of marijuana, you know. It's a lot of marijuana if you see a pound of marijuana. Spread it all out, right? And they would cut that with oregano, very common to do back in the day, especially. But then they would spray it all down with Black Flag roach poison. Why would you do that? And they tell you, because it gets you high, because it hits you. We had a case in the Bronx when I was a young cop. Poor girl went missing. You know, I was talking about missing people before, right? Young girl went missing. She's like 15, 16 years old. I can't remember. Nice family. Parents were Irish immigrants, sent her to Catholic school in the Bronx, and got mixed up with some kids completely innocently, hanging out, smoking pot with them. These kids were like, you know, 18, 19 years old. They were young men, right? But they were bad guys. Her and her girlfriend smoked with them, hung out, and she decided she's going to go meet this boy by herself. So we're all looking for her. We got to find this girl, right? Did she get picked up by this boy? The last time we knew, all we knew was she was going to meet this boy, blah, 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 blah. Found her like 5 days, 6 days, 7 days later, something like that. What had happened was these boys were from a gang on Crescent Avenue. And they had, when they got her alone, they got her high. They were putting a crack in the marijuana. Basically abducted her, took her back to the thing. They all raped her. They passed her all around. And they put her out on Jerome Avenue as a prostitute. Then just the way fate works, it wasn't the detectives looking for this young girl. It was CPOP guys. CPOPs are community policing. So they were out doing outreach can we help you out? You need a place to stay. Can we get you off the street? How can we help you? And it's like this young girl. And I say, wait a second. Click, click. We're looking for you. And thank God it was only 6-7 days into this ordeal. And she was like, yes, please take me home. As opposed to some young women who get caught up in it and get so destroyed by the drugs that they never can go home. They can't get themselves to go home, you know, because they become part of the life.
You would just think she's out on the street, run away, run home. But it's this control, this control fear. Through violence and threats. And what was one of the biggest cases, like, I guess, organized crime or murder or whatever that you got?
I was involved in a few murders. I was funny. A lot of the murderers that I actually locked up was because of drugs, and we didn't would even know it. You know, like we did a warrant once on Rochambeau Avenue, and we grabbed this guy, locked him up, cuffed him up, whole thing. Guy was wanted for 3 homicides in Puerto Rico, a triple homicide. He killed 3 people in Puerto Rico. You know, this is where we would stumble across these people all the time. As far as famous, there's really nothing famous ever happens in the Bronx because it's the lost borough and nobody cares. So you can have, you know, I could tell you all kinds of awful stories about people getting shot up, stabbed up, murdered, you know, this God awful stories I could tell you. And if you want to hear some of them, surely tell you. But you can compare that. Somebody stubs their toe in Central Park, it's going to make the front page of the news or the Times. Demographic of the people that you're dealing with.
Yeah. Let me rephrase that. Which one were you maybe the most proud of or felt the most accomplished as opposed to biggest?
Well, the most accomplished. My goodness. That's an interesting question because I never had it put to me quite like that. I'll tell you some just interesting things that happened as far as things that were interesting. When we were in SNU one time, we had locked up a guy and we had to fight with him. All right. This actually wasn't Myers. It was a young man named Tommy White, who I liked very much. He ended up being a lieutenant on the job. Real nice kid from the Bronx himself. And we got this guy and we're fighting with him. We get him, we lock him up. He was older than us. Now, granted, we're all in our 20s and early 30s at the time. This guy's like in his 50s. So he's like an old man, right?
Yeah.
A real well-built, attractive Italian fella, right? Which was unusual in this neighborhood. And he had a smoking hot Puerto Rican girlfriend with him. So we get him, we fight with him, we lock him up, we bring him back to the precinct.
Yeah.
And we're doing his paperwork. All I can remember was his first name was Dominic. I don't remember much else. We strip him, and he's got bullet holes all over his body. Your listeners can't see, but I'm pointing to my chest. They're all over his belly and his chest. He got bullet holes, right? So this guy's got a story. Sure enough, who shows up as we're finishing up the processing? The FBI. This guy was a guy. He was out. He was a big made mafioso guy. He was one of the original Purple Gang. Purple Gang, if you look them up, they were kind of like the farm team for the Genovese and Bonanno crime families in New York City. So a lot of kids on 116th and Pleasant Avenue, that was very Italian when I was a kid. But it was heavily, heavily organized crime location. And we had inadvertently picked up a guy that they'd been chasing for a long time and couldn't get my answer. And you know, I, of course, I'm a ball breaker because that's what we all are, you know. So all you had to do was follow him around. You would have caught him. We caught him buying heroin with his girlfriend.
Yeah.
And so that was interesting.
But he didn't go easy. He didn't go without a
did
fight.
Not go easy. But I tell you what, once we got him, he was a complete gentleman.
Yeah.
And in fact, he had a funny quote too. He said, let me tell you something. I've been locked up many times. He said, there's nobody cooler than New York cops. He said, you guys are so down to earth. You know? Like we're just having a regular conversation, you know? So, and there's some truth to that too. I mean, I had a guy one time I had a lot, and this all comes down to personality, you know? I locked up this heroin dealer in Poe Park. Poe Park is actually named after Edgar Allan Poe because his house sits there, all right? Because he used to live in the Bronx. People don't know that. And I was in SNU at the time again. And if your team was in court or you didn't have enough guys to go out, they'd put you in uniform. You take a foot post, you know, to get rid of your day. So I went down to 194th Street because that was a really hot block. You know, a lot of drugs, a lot of bad stuff. We, you know, all the way to my time in SNU and narcotics, I would work down there. And I saw this guy, Gabriel, and I knew Gabriel because we had locked him up before, but he'd gotten away from me one time, right? And we had a wanted card on him because back then he used to fill out a little card that he was wanted. And then that was it. He'd get picked up by anybody at any time. Right. So I saw him. He was slinging heroin in the park. I walked up to him and they're not afraid of you when you're in uniform because uniform guys don't lock them up. Narcotics guys lock them up. Plainclothes guys are who they're afraid of. I walked right up to him and I shook his hand. Gabriel, how the hell are you? And the guy made a mistake and shook my hand, right? Because now I got him. I put him up against the fence of the Edgar Allan Poe cottage. He's holding on to that. The guy turns and elbows me and hits me just below the throat and the chest, right? And takes off like a shot.
Yeah.
So I go running after this guy. And he runs down Kingsbridge Road. And the Grand Concourse is an overpass that goes over Kingsbridge Road. He runs underneath. And as he does, he jumps over those, you know, those concrete barriers that are always on the highway. They're about 3 feet high. They're kind of with the rounded edges, right? He hops over that like a little gazelle. And I reach over and I just barely grab a hold of his sweatshirt with my left hand, right? And I try to leap over it, but kind of get caught. Boom, we both go down on the floor and bang, bang, I crack him a couple times. And I'm holding him down on the street, you know, in the middle of Kingsbridge Road with my left hand. And the fucker turns and bites me, gets a hold of my middle finger, bites me real good. I mean, breaks the skin. I got a little scar on it and everything, right? Long story short, get him locked up. And while I got him there, this poor Sergeant Vinny Geiso, I think his name was, he was a Central Park cop, all right? And he made Sergeant, and they, poor bastard, they sent him to the Bronx. They had no idea what they were doing to this kid. Really, really nice kid, though. And I got to search him again, because now you search him again when you're in front of the priest. Like, I had already got a brick of heroin, which was, and I say, Gabriel, tell me the truth now. I'm going to go through your pocket, your socks, your shoes, anything that's going to hurt me. You got a razor, you got your works in there. Works are, you know, your needles and stuff like that, you know? And he's like, no. He's being very unhappy. He's very unhappy with me because I just gave him a beating in the street and locked him up. He's, you know, his life is not going his way today. And sure enough, the guy's got his works in his pocket. Thank God I didn't poke myself because that's the whole thing. As it happens, not to get away from the story, I had to go for weeks because back then when you got an AIDS test, you had to go like every 2 weeks to make sure you didn't have it. And I had to get tested because he bit me. Yeah. Right. So right then, you know, try to picture, you know, we have those big high desks and there's a bunch of people waiting to get their complaints done. You know, it's the middle of the day because it was morning when this happened. Okay. And boom, I crack him right in the mouth, right there in front of the sergeant, in front of everybody. Big no, you shouldn't do this, right? But he got me. He hooked me because, you motherfucker, I just asked you and I'm pulling all this shit out of your pockets now. Then we go back, we do our stuff. I got to search from the bathroom just to set the tone. I got rough with him in the bathroom again. Listen, I got to spend the next 8 hours with you, or, you know, plus or minus, because back then you spent your entire time with your prisoner until you released him into central booking, and it took a long time. Okay, so you could easily spend 8 hours from arrest to end of the arrest. So if you arrest somebody at the end of your tour, you got yourself 8 hours of overtime. Beginning of your tour, overtime wasn't an issue. Okay, so anyway, I get this guy. We go through all of our processing. All right. Oh, when I give him the speech in the bathroom, I said, you know, listen, we're going to spend all this time together. Act like a gentleman. I'll treat you like a gentleman. If you want to act like a jerk, I will bring you in here and treat you like a jerk. Just to set the tone, know who you're dealing with. If you're cool, I'll get you a candy bar. I'll get you a slice of pizza. I'll make sure you have something before you go away. All right. Long story short, I did. I got him a slice of pizza and a soda. We did all of our processing, our printing, all the paperwork I had to do. Because back then, again, it wasn't just typing in the computer. We literally filled out pen and paper. We filled out the paperwork, right? I go down and drop him off at central booking, at which point I now have to go to court and talk to the district attorney. So I got another couple hours ahead of me. And when we get there, poor kid's got stitches in his head, all right? Got lumped up by me a couple of times. He reaches his hand through the bar and shakes my hand. Yo, Travis, you're the coolest cop I ever met. Because he knew he was the bad guy. He knew I was the good guy. And once our initial
confrontation
was over, I treated him like a gentleman.
Yeah.
You know? But I made it very clear. If you act like a gentleman, I'll treat you like a gentleman. You know, and then you got some bad guys who are just going to make it miserable for you the whole time. And then they wonder why you're being miserable to them. Probably the best cop show ever made was The Wire. Mm-hmm. Okay.
And agree.
No, absolutely. And it's the closest thing. See, what people don't see is on our end, on the police end, they don't see the boredom. They don't see the hours on the roof. They tried to show you that in there, but they couldn't. Because who's going to, you're going to watch me sit on a roof for 6 hours? No, of course not. That's the most boring thing in your life. But that's what police work is. Police work is unbelievably boring. Hours and hours of boredom, hours and hours of going to bullshit call after call after call. And when I say bullshit, it may be important to the people calling at the time, but really when you get there, it's not a police matter. There's nothing we can do. You know, it gets to be like you know, on a busy night, not every day, you know, but you might do 25 calls, jobs, you know, where you're getting called over the radio, maybe more. Try to forget 25 or 28. Try to fit 20 into 8 hours. You're going, man. You're going. Yeah. Job after job after job after job. Central's holding jobs for your sector because, you know, you might only be turning out 4 or 5 cars for your precinct. And you have to answer all of these cars. The patrol guys get no credit for the work that they do because they are rushing from job to job to job. Quite often, if they're holding jobs, you can't take a meal. So now you don't get lunch today. And then you'll get the thing. And again, these are busy houses, okay, where you literally drive up and you'll say, what's going on? What happened? And you get the story. Is anybody hurt? No? Okay, we'll see you later. Because I got 3 jobs waiting. And they're coming over as serious jobs. Because idiots will do that too, where they're mad at their neighbor upstairs for making so much noise. But they know the cops are only going to come if there's a gun involved. So they make it a gun run. And here we are like idiots, racing there as fast as we can, hopefully not getting into a car accident or running over some civilian, running up 3 or 4 flights of stairs, heart pounding out of our chest. I thought it was a gun run. Oh, well, we heard something upset, but you hear the music, boom, 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 or an ambulance call. People don't realize in the Bronx, I don't know if they've changed it, but in bad neighborhoods in New York City, if it's an ambulance run, the police more often than not have to show up. They do that for the safety of the ambulance drivers. In fact, you know, EMTs in New York City, a lot of them wear bulletproof vests because it's such a crazy job and they're going into crazy buildings. Paramedics and EMTs don't have guns, so we go to make sure everything is cool, you know, especially if it's late at night, especially if it's a particularly bad block, especially if it's a questionable circumstance.
I've been on a police ride along. I've gone to police use of force seminars. I've done a lot of different community things with local police departments because I can get on YouTube and that algorithm will take me down that route where every cop is bad. You know, I can get on the algorithm where, you know, I think every single arrest is brutality, but you have to counter your own beliefs and feelings sometimes. And it was very eye-opening to see all of the bullshit calls on my police ride-along. Yes. It was so... His shift wasn't over for another 3 hours, but we go back to, you know, his department and he's like, I'm going to be filling out paperwork for the rest of the day. He's like, you can sit here if you want.
Yeah.
And then I sat there for 20 minutes watching him try to input a firearm he had found while out on patrol. And he's using the oldest computer I've ever seen with the oldest drop-down menu, like Windows is out, you know, this is, you know, yeah. And he's on this AS400 green screen monochrome thing. And I'm like, how long does it take you to fill out a police report? And he goes, 20 to 30 minutes for each one because it's so antiquated. And I left at that point. I'm like, I'm not going to watch you do this because
in my time, we were still using, you know, the old IBM, whatever they were, Electrolux typewriters. It wasn't computers then. They called them word processors. But if you wanted a word processor, you had to buy it yourself. They didn't give it to you. We were still rolling fingerprints with ink. Okay. The rest of the country had computerized jobs. We would just touch it and it would do it. All right.
Yeah. The digital ones. Yeah.
We got ours maybe, I don't know, the year before I left. So, you know, 90, 98, 99 in that neighborhood, we got the digital fingerprint ones, but we got Houston's old ones. We didn't get brand new ones. People think New York City is the biggest police department in the world. People don't realize it's the biggest police department in the world, okay? And there's a job for everybody. If you are not necessarily a patrol guy, a detective guy, if you're a photographer, you can find a job within the New York City Police Department. You know, there's so many fascinating jobs that they have, but there is zero money. And so when we finally got our fancy new high-speed things, they were hand-me-downs from the Houston Police Department, which I just thought was hilarious. And, you know, our cars, when I was in narcotics and in the plainclothes units like anti-crime and SNU, do you guys have Rent-A-Wreck where you guys are?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
It's just beat up old cars that they're rentals, but they're always cheap. Yeah. And the city has a contract with them, which actually is pretty good and I guess smart because the thing is you can change them. If there's a problem with one, they change it out, you know? Yeah. But also it's good because you're always driving something that nobody would ever think anybody in their right mind would be driving as a policeman. Yeah. You know, you have a bang up old Ford Taurus, or the next day you have a, a banged up old Lincoln Town Car, something like that. It would just switch up all the time. That was our rental unit that we would get our cars from.
You mentioned The Wire, and we mentioned some other things about bullshit calls. When I worked in corporate America, I did IT work, and I could come to your computer and fix it. But the hardest part of my job wasn't fixing the computer. It was the bureaucracy of the process of fixing the computer, engaging with people. What was the hardest part of being a police officer? And I'm assuming it's the bureaucracy, but I could be wrong.
Well, I'm gonna agree with you there. I'll go in both directions. The beauty of the police department is the camaraderie, and that mostly everybody's in it together. The bad part of that, of course, is that it does become very much, and there's no getting around this. They'll never be able to cure this. I don't care what kind of nonsense stuff they want to talk about on the news, but the whole us against them mentality, part of that comes from what I'm going to get to you about the bad part. Most cops in general want to be there. They want to do their jobs, but then they are kept from doing their jobs from the police department and the district attorney's office and the mayor's office. And well, what do you mean by that? Well, it's that simple, where they put so many restrictions on you and or demands that you can't fulfill. You can't do your job. Okay. And it becomes very disheartening. You know, the whole, like, the shit that these kids are going through now, I don't know how they do it. I don't know how it is where you are, but you know, in New York, we have the bail reform thing. So if you lock up somebody, I mean, there's people who have been locked up dozens of times. Okay. And I mean, for things like bank robbery, guns, violent assaults, robberies, et cetera, et cetera. And literally, they're out the same day. They're out within 24 hours. That is beyond comprehension, because these are vile, violent, awful people, you know, and they're locked up and they're right back out. So it gets to be.
And that's something that's like, I think bail reform was needed because it does impact, you know, poor people way more when you can't afford bail. But that, to the rest of the world, that's not what it was for. It was not to let out violent people. It was to let out a kid that did something stupid that day
or
somebody who's poor. It's like a good idea on paper in theory, but in practice, it just goes awry.
And that's the thing too, that goes up the ladder also, where quite often judges, all right? So we're talking about taking away the authority from the police, but also the authority from the district attorney's office, and also the authority from the judges themselves. And it's tragic, all right, because you know the bad guys now they have a green light to do whatever they want to do. But can you imagine yourself now? I mean, take a pick of any of these jobs. You know, you're selling your soul to it. You're not getting paid very much. It hurts your family. And I'm talking about all of them, even up the ladder to the judges, you know, and they're going to tell you you're a judge and you can't judge.
And it goes both ways. Like sometimes there's a mandatory minimum. So now this judge has to put this kid away for 5 years when really maybe the kid deserved another chance, or you have to let them go because they didn't steal enough. You know, they stole under $500. Yeah. So now they get to walk.
The only way, the only thing where I'll flip that over on you. Yeah. Okay. And I know every municipality is different. And so I'm not trying to defend anybody. I'm not trying to argue with you, but so you understand. And you should understand this stuff too, because you do, you know, your life now is all of this criminal legal stuff, right?
Yeah.
Is that, especially in New York City or any major city, so I'm sure it's the same in Kansas City, all right? 99% of the people that actually go to jail have records as long as your arm. Because get arrested. And by the fifth, sixth, eighth time, the judge will put the hammer on them. Okay. And that's truly the case most of the time. Now, there was mandatory sentencing. One thing, which again boggles my mind when it comes to, our gun control advocates, is that in New York City, one of the best things they ever did was they made it a mandatory 1 year for an illegal handgun. That is a great deterrent. And it makes sense because you know for a fact. That's how it was always my thing. When I would grab a guy and you're like, you know, what are you locking me up for? You know, I'm only a user, or I carry this gun for protection or whatever. Things that I can understand. Remember, I'm from New York City. I can understand this. Okay. But you knew when you woke up, you knew it was illegal. All right. I've never written a speeding ticket in my life. We don't do that in New York City. You know, well, we don't. They have highway guys that do that. Right. But
you can't speed there anyways.
but you yourself, Justin, you've gotten a summons sometime in your life.
Yeah.
All right. And you didn't do it because the cop was picking on you. He may have been a gentleman. He may have been a dick, but it was because you were speeding. That's it. If you're smoking marijuana, personally, the smoking marijuana thing, I never did that. My entire career in the police department, I locked up one guy ever for lighting up. And that's because we had to have a number. That's how stupid it was. You had to have one because nobody was doing it, because in the Bronx, we didn't bother with that. It was always a bigger fish to fry, you know? And there's a thing that people don't realize either, especially in the busier place, is that, let's say I'm on patrol. We take ourselves out of service for a low-level crime. You know what happens? Those other three cars have to pick up our jobs. Remember those 20 jobs a night I was talking about? So now I'm going to hand 8 jobs to 3 more cars because I decided to lock this guy up because I found him with a bag of heroin, or I found him with a nickel bag of marijuana, or I found him graffitiing something. All things that you're not supposed to do, but the police don't want to do that. They want to get the bad guys. But then they come down and say, look, you have to have at least one number.
This quota. Yeah.
Exactly. They'll say it's not a quota. It's what do they call it? Suggested activity. Okay.
There's the bureaucracy right there.
Exactly. And that's and I'll tell you what, that's not coming from my sergeant or my lieutenant or my captain. That's coming from some chief down at One Police Plaza, because he has to have something to give to the commissioner or the mayor or whoever, that all the boxes are checked. And these particular precincts, because they're dealing with so much more bullshit, aren't checking those boxes. I mean, things they came out with a thing one time, which I never did, where they wanted you to give out summonses for people riding their bicycle on the sidewalk. Yes, it's awful when you're walking down the street and a guy comes down on the bicycle. It's dangerous. It's wrong. It's blah, 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 blah. But the idea that they're going to make you go out and look for people riding their bicycle on a sidewalk in the Bronx, you know, when I was in there in my first year in the Bronx, it all got drastically better under Mayor Giuliani, as we all know. Love him or hate him, it's best thing that ever happened to New York City, because he did such a great job of bringing the murder rate down, the crime rate down, all the quality of life crimes down, et cetera, et cetera. But when I first showed up, we had something like 69 homicides in my precinct alone. Now, my precinct was about 1 mile wide and 2 miles long, so it's a very small area. The precinct below me, the 4-6 precinct, that's 1 mile square, and they had like almost 100 homicides. It was like 95, 98 homicides that they had. Ridiculous. And you're going to ask me to find somebody riding a bicycle on a sidewalk, you know?
Every morning, I'm sure you go in for your morning briefing, and they give you the priority of the day. And when you hear bicyclists on the sidewalk, I'm surprised that everyone didn't burst out laughing.
Oh, well, we did. We did. You know? Sergeants didn't take it seriously, or the lieutenants. No. But again, you had to have a number. That doesn't make the numbers not necessary. You see what I'm saying? You have to perform for whatever it is. You got to dance the dance. You know what I'm saying? When I got bit, that story I told you a little bit while ago, when I got bit, okay? I never forget. I took that case in. It was a narcotics case. And the ADA that got it, because again, now she's a young girl, you know, probably all of 25, if that, okay? And I remember, you know, she's got a stack of cases on her desk that she has to get rid of. This is not a buy and bust operation. There's no undercover involved. There's no weight. Even though he's got, you know, whatever he had, you know, 10, 12 bags of heroin on him. I got him from a sale. You know, the original arrest was from a sale a couple of weeks before. Long story short, we're going to knock the drugs to a misdemeanor, even though they're a felony. We're going to knock the assault to a misdemeanor. Assault. The guy
on a police officer.
In my fingers. Yeah. Okay. I had to have 3 stitches to get that hole sewed up. And I got to go for AIDS testing for the next 6, 8, 10 weeks, whatever it is that I got to go get tested. And I have to think the whole time. Now, when I go home, I can't sleep with my wife. Back then, they were so afraid. You couldn't, if you were bathing, they wanted you to clean the bathtub out so that somebody didn't get AIDS off of you. Now, we know that not to be the case now, but we didn't know that then. We were terrified of this shit, right? Anyways, it all got dropped to nothing. In his particular case, for this kid Gabriel, all right, when I say Gabriel, he was older than me at the time, I think, all right? He turned out he was an ex-con who was on parole, and that's why he was fighting me so hard. I get a call from a parole officer in Rikers Island, which, you know, he says, hey, I understand this guy bit you. He said, yeah. He says, well, why isn't this a felony? I said, I asked the district attorney's office. He says, well, I'll tell you what, I'll violate him. So what happened was he had to go serve his bad time. He didn't get any time for fighting me, biting me, selling drugs. And remember now I had the two cases because I had him for this sale and I had him for the other sale. Okay. None of that he got time for. But because he got violated by the parole officer, he had to go back and serve whatever it was, his 2 or 3 years that he had for bad time. Something that people don't understand either, okay, just about policing in general, it's all reactionary for the most part. And we all say, well, we want proactive policing, which SNU is proactive policing, narcotics is proactive policing, anti-crime, which I told you about before, that's proactive policing. All of these things New York City no longer has. They got rid of units like that because police officers were going out to get bad guys rather than reacting to the crimes, okay? Which was a good, positive thing, just like CPOP. CPOP was a good, community policing is a good thing. And people always say, we need more community policing, but it's not fun and attractive to look at because it's boring. SNU, like I said before, a bunch of guys going out and grabbing a bunch of drug dealers is not interesting. It's boring because it's the life that they live. You know, we lock them up. Even like when we talk about The Wire, it didn't get interesting until people started getting murdered. That's what you want to see. Mm-hmm. You don't care about it otherwise. The public I'm talking about.
Yeah.
You see what I'm saying? And so it isn't, what do you say? The actual police work is not the clickbaity stuff that you want, you know, unfortunately. I am very much a patriotic guy. Mm-hmm. I think we have just a world of problems in this country. But what we have is opportunity, you know, where a guy like a completely uneducated guy like me can grow up to own his own house, to send his kids to college, to do, you know, many things that I've done with my life that have been fairly positive. But there's a huge disconnect between us, the working class, the working people. And when I say working people, I'm talking about even doctors and lawyers. People think that they're rich. They're not. They had to break their ass to get there. They had to go through all that school to get there. They're in debt up to their ears to get there. Many of them came from working families themselves, and they still have to work. I mean, I know, you know, lawyer friends of mine who literally start work at 8 a.m. and aren't done until 8 p.m. because they have to get through all this crap. And the second their workload is over, they now have to hustle up some new work because if those cases, whatever the case is, if you're a divorce lawyer, once that's over, you got to find a new one. So they're constantly working. It's a constant hustle, right? And then we have this much smaller, you know, the whole kind of one percenter group of elites who entrench themselves, you know, on the top and in our politics, you know, like to push the buttons of government, who do not care one bit about us.
No.
And this is all I got, my friend.
Yeah.
This is it. And you know what? At my age, I'm lucky if I got another 20 years. So yeah, I'm not going to be miserable. I'm going to say hello to everybody that I make eye contact with. I've always been that way anyway. I'm going to tip my waitress well or my bartender well. If you and I have a disagreement, so what? You don't know what you're talking about. I don't have to argue with you. I don't have to fight with you. I can think you're wrong without hating you. And the stuff that goes on today, I really believe the drama, again, the broken record, is pushed by social media and the media as a whole. I really do. I mean, at my house, I can't even watch the news anymore. We got rid of cable because there was nothing that we liked. And all of this shit, if it's CNN, Fox, MSNBC, they're all liars. And they all have an agenda. So you're not watching the news anymore.
You know? Commentary. It's just opinion pieces and commentary.
It's nonsense. It's garbage. It's absolute garbage. Things like that are heartbreaking to me because we want to believe in something. But you know what? Here's a bit of positivity in a world of negativity. Travis does believe in the goodness of humanity. How's that? Back to the 90% thing. You know what? 90% of people are decent people. That doesn't mean I'm inviting them over for Thanksgiving dinner. You know what I'm saying?
Yes, I do, Travis. And thank you so much for coming on the show. Again, I want to point everybody out to Travis's books. Search for Sister Margaret, a Tommy Keene novel. They're pretty amazing. Also, check out the show notes. I'll have a link in there.
Knowing how to speak and understand a new language can be an invaluable tool when traveling, meeting new friends, or just even to master a new skill. But it's not always simple when you're bogged down by textbooks and structure classes. That's why so many people trust Rosetta Stone. Rosetta Stone is the most trusted language learning program, available on desktop or as an app. It truly immerses you in the language you want to learn, like Spanish, French, Italian, Chinese, and more. You won't just be studying English translations. The Rosetta Stone intuitive process helps you pick up a language naturally, first with words, then phrases, then sentences. Don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/rs10. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/rs10 today.